You've done very well so far, Mr. Magnus Carlsen, but what do you say to this?
You can't do the Kalashnikov rook move in this situation.
And yet I have. Jonathan, hi. I can only talk for a second, but what's up, darling?
You can't talk at all. This is a chess championship.
I'm in India, playing chess against Magnus Carlsen. No, no, you know him. He's the Justin Bieber guy of chess. Right. So did you get to see Phil play last weekend? Was it good? Well, of course it was good. It was Phil.
You have to hang up the phone.
Hey, why don't you worry a little bit less about what I'm doing and a little more about where you're going to move your prawn?
That's pawn.
His abs? I don't know. I can't see them. My friend Jonathan says you supposedly have really great abs. Is this true?
I work out.
Pull up your shirt. I'll Instagram it.
I will not. And here is my next move.
That was a good move. Now remind me about the horsey guys. They move like two and then one, right? Do they have any other powers or anything?
No.
Okay, I'm going to move it here. I think I pinned you. Hey, Jonathan, I think I just pinned the Justin Bieber of chess.
It's not even called pinning. I can't believe this.
Now he's turning all red because he's so mad. It's so cute. I'll ask him. Hey, Magnus Bieber, do you want to go out sometime? Just, you know, get something to eat? I bet they have Indian food here.
No!
Ugh, what a sore loser. Today on the show, Mike Pesca plays speed chess with topics from the news. Paul Bass covers the board games and New Haven politics. And a real female grandmaster breaks down the chess world championship happening right now in India. And now, in the World Candyland tournament, he tested positive for Skittles. Colin McEnroe.
It is true, not that, but it is true that at the end of the show today, we'll be talking to Susan Polgar. She's an international chess grandmaster, sort of the person who broke the gender barrier in chess. And she's also one of three Hungarian chess-playing sisters. And I will let you draw your own Gabor sister parallels. But when you hear her accent, you'll see. Anyway, she's going to tell us about what's going on in Chennai, India right now. There actually is a high-profile chess tournament, which doesn't happen very often. But meanwhile, what we do on Mondays is we cover a lot of things that kind of came up over the weekend. And one of the things we like to do is just call up interesting people that we know and see what they want to talk about, see what's been percolating in their brains. And one of the people we like to do that with a lot is Mike Pesca. He is, of course, America's greatest sports journalist. But he's always thinking about a whole range of other things. And some of those things, you know, in his normal NPR role, you might not get to hear some of those other things. So we make sure he gets to do them here. So, Mike Pesca, welcome back to our Monday show. And so we're going to start by, I think, talking about the value of actually seeing a place you hear about, a place you read about, a place you watch Nova specials about, but haven't seen with your own eyes. So tell us more about this.
Well, I will. But I got to say, that right there, that was a classic chess open, Colin. Yeah, so I was thinking about this with the Kennedy assassination, the 50th anniversary coming up, and I've always been interested in history, and I think most people are really drawn to and fascinated by the circumstances around that, you know, the most debated, mysterious, important formative event probably in the last 50 to 100 years. But until I went there, until I was in Dallas, and until I could actually digest these things that have become totemic, I never had a chance of getting my brain around it. So one classic example is the grassy knoll, which, because it has, it's phrased in that weird way, seems, I don't know, more important than it is, which is just, it's nothing. It's just a patch of grass. I mean, we could call any little tuft of grass at any place in a city a grassy knoll, and I guess then we'd all, you know, debate it forever, and it seems the pretentiousness of it just increases. But I guess grassy knoll makes it seem a lot more important than a little patch of grass, but really that's all it is.
Only knoll people ever, not counting Chuck anyway, it's the only knoll people ever talk about. It's not like there's another knoll in people's
right
lives.
Cementy knolls, yeah. And you know, ashen knolls. No, just grassy knolls. And then when you see the turn that it made, the car made, and you just realize, because if you go to the sixth floor museum, the book depository, and you stand exactly where Oswald stood, unless you feel he's a total patsy and didn't even take the shots, you just see, you can imagine how long, you know, Kennedy was in his sights, and you feel it. You feel it in a way. I know this is true with a lot of places that you can't get it from textbooks. You can only get part of the feeling. But I've never felt more underinformed by something that I thought I was really informed about until I went to Dallas and kind of stood in that area and saw where the three highways divided and stood in the book depository. And I think it has something to do with the specifics of the Kennedy assassination. I mean, I've been to other places that are historic, and as a sports correspondent, you go to, I don't know, Fenway Park. Well, I went to Fenway Park, and I'm like, oh, I think this is what Fenway Park's going to be like. And it was pretty much like that. Like, the Green Monster was a big green wall, and it wasn't underwhelming. It was really cool to see. But there wasn't so much that surprised me that I'd never realized these little intricacies. But with the Kennedy assassination especially and some other things I've been to, going there makes all the difference and makes you care about it so much more and makes you understand it in a way, even as we're sold on, you know, this being the future and everything could be virtual. I don't agree with that at all. I think that until you're there, you'll never really grasp it. I don't know if there's been other situations like that for you.
Well, there have, but I think you're right also that there's something special about this, and so much of it is because of its unique place in history, where it was one of the first. I mean, people can go to Normandy, but I mean, there aren't competing theories really about what happened at D-Day, and there aren't logistical issues about what could or could not have happened at D-Day. There isn't this vast cavalcade of people with their own amateur theories about what happened there that are competing and are assaultive to the accepted historical record, to the extent that the Kennedy assassination could even be said to have an accepted historical record. So, I mean, what we had there in 1963 was, first of all, people kind of had the tools for the first time to analyze something on their own to an unprecedented degree. And then a certain number of things kind of happened live before people. People saw Oswald get shot by Ruby kind of, you know, all at once. It wasn't packaged up by anybody else. The whole thing kind of unfolded in real time. And then you had this general undercurrent of dissatisfaction with the official record, with the work of the Warren Commission. So this is something where people... You know, I mean, you can go to Paris and walk through some of the sites of the French Revolution, but you probably don't have a whole competing theory of the French Revolution that you need to investigate while you're in Paris.
Right.
Whereas this is something where, like, everybody sort of had an opportunity to be kind of an expert if they wanted to.
Right. And also, I was going to say, you know, the very nature of it, I was thinking of, it's not underwhelming to go to the Louvre and to see the Mona Lisa, but because the Mona Lisa is so very small, exactly how you imagined it is exactly what it's going to be. You know there's going to be a huge crowd, and you look at this picture, and it looks like the Mona Lisa that you've seen so often, and you're there, but I don't know how much different your take on the Mona Lisa is going to be. In fact, I would say with art, except for things like size that you don't expect, call me a Philistine, but when I go online and see a good high-res image of a lot of art, I get the art. Now, Guernica is different, and a huge picture like Washington crossing the Delaware may be a little different, although once you're told it's huge, you get it. It's big. It's Washington crossing the Delaware. You go to Dallas, and you go to some other place like this. I think Gettysburg is a little like this, too, and you get to see how all the dimensions relate to each other, and I was thinking, you know, it's four-dimensional because it's the three-dimensional before you, the fourth dimension being time, but it's really five-dimensional because we can't even agree what the timeline is. So one of the dimensions is the time, the official timeline, and one of the dimensions maybe encapsulates everything that's, you know, the unofficial story of the Kennedy assassination. So that's why it's valuable.
I think this has been sort of an interesting time generationally too, this the 50th anniversary. I do feel as though the next major anniversary, the anniversary of the 75th, will be different because right now I think the nation is divided between people who remember this and for whom it looms incredibly large in their consciousnesses and people who were born afterwards, for whom it's nowhere near as important, nowhere near as numinous as this is. And 25 years from now, I'll be 84. And I mean, the people who remember this are going to be either old or gone. This will be the last really big Kennedy assassination marker where a lot of people really, really heavily invested in it really get to churn it over.
Although it happened 10 years before I was born, and, you know, I'm a history buff, but people of my exact age, I think, are interested. And I think a big part is it doesn't actually seem like history. It seems because there's color footage. I think that's a just just a huge factor. And I think the Kennedys were more or less modern people, and of course, you know, their generation span into the modern age, so they're tangible and they're touchable, and we got them as something other than a sepia-toned thing from a history book. But there are definitely things like that. I think D-Day and World War II and what all that, all those, you know, 75th and 80th anniversary things meant take on that tone that you're talking about.
All right, we're talking to Mike Pesca right now, but we're not talking about sports, although we will touch on sports right at the end, but we're going to switch tracks here. I'm going to play a clip of a politician talking about something that his audience doesn't really want to hear. Unfortunately, or almost necessarily, it's not a real politician. But here we go.
Yeah.
Governor Bartlett, when you were a member of Congress, you voted against the New England Dairy Farming Compact. That vote hurt me, sir. I'm a businessman, and that vote hurt me to the tune of maybe 10 cents a gallon. And I voted for you three times for congressman. I voted for you twice for governor. And I'm here, sir, and I'd like to ask you for an explanation.
Yeah. I screwed you on that one.
I'm sorry?
I screwed you. You got hosed.
Sir,
I... Not just you. A lot of my constituents. I put the hammer to farms and Concord, Salem, Laconia, Pelham, Hampton, Hudson. You guys got Roger, but good.
Now, he goes on to explain that the reason that he did this had to do with children, had to do with the price of milk for children, with the, his overriding notion that, that an American child with without a lot of means should have access to affordable milk. And so he went that way, understanding that there were a whole bunch of other dug-in interests who would get really mad at him. Of course, the person talking is Judd Bartlett, who's the president of the United States on the West Wing, but not in real life. So, Mike Pesca, over the weekend, you've been talking, thinking to yourself about what happens when politicians have to tell somebody an uncomfortable or maybe even unpleasant truth.
Right. So I was thinking about this because I read the big New Republic article on Elizabeth Warren, which is basically about her electability and could she run against Hillary Clinton. But so much of that article had facts like or assertions like they would talk about, and there was also a big Peter Bunnert article that talked about this too, which is they would say, here's where young Democrats, here's what their opinions are. And they would match up opinions which may seem, you know, very liberal or progressive or whatever you want to call them, things like banks are more or business are more interested in profits than in or in general banks. I keep saying banks. Businesses make the world a better place than they do just concentrate on their profits. And it used to be that the majority of people didn't believe in it, and now they do. So all throughout the article, he kind of took Elizabeth Warren's stances and said, "See, this is what people believe. See, she's a candidate for our times because you know there's more and more people, especially in the Democratic caucus, who would believe that. You know, never kind of want." And it was a great article, and I don't criticize him, but we don't do this. Never kind of one thing. The reason she would be a good politician is because she's really convincing. And here's a stance that 30% of people agree with. But you know what? She could get it. She could get you around to maybe 50 or 55% of people believing it. We've totally lost the ideal of a good arguer can convince you, can make the unpopular stance, knowing it's unpopular, and could bring you around. When I hear that Bartlett quote, you know, in the fiction of the story, it's one thing. But really, who is the constituency for Bartlett's speech? It's the home viewer watching the show The West Wing, which is about liberal wish fulfillment. And that's the category of most quote-unquote unpopular political speech is heralded as something that's really brave. But really, it's, you know, I don't always say the popular thing. And this will be someone talking to, like, the Tea Party. I say, you've got to cut spending, and then everyone will cheer, right? It's appealing to a niche group where that really is the popular stance. And when I think about, in my lifetime, the politician who just says, I take this stance, and I know it's unpopular, and I know it could cost my election, is Mario Cuomo. Mario Cuomo was against the death penalty. He knew all the polls said it was that he was against the death penalty, and he still, at every opportunity, explained why he was against the death penalty and why maybe you should be against the death penalty. Now, at that point, Mario Cuomo couldn't flip-flop, and he'd look like a big hypocrite, and if you want to play real politic with me, you'd say he was making the best of his bad stance, his electorally bad stance. But I just don't remember too many times when a candidate said, yeah, not only in the primary, but in the general, people aren't with me on this, but I'm going to say it over and over again. And I think a reason for that is polling. Polling tells the politicians exactly where the public stands, and that limits the politicians, and the politicians don't make those arguments. I mean, the entire history of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, if they had really accurate polls about where Illinois stood on those issues, I mean, maybe we think of both these guys as sticking to their guns, but maybe the really accurate polling would have destroyed the rhetoric of the Lincoln-Douglas debates, or at least our perception of the rhetoric, because in real life they lasted like 3 hours and were pretty boring, and if you were far away, you couldn't hear.
Yeah, just very quickly, too. I mean, the other thing that the New Republic article that you cited talks about is the potential that Hillary Clinton could play, as they say, a clever game, striking a more populist and therefore Elizabeth Warren-like stance toward Wall Street while slyly winking at her donors, who are pragmatic enough to understand what's going on here, what kind of game is being played. Although I think voters read that stuff reasonably well. I think maybe I'm overestimating voters, but I think if you try to pretend that you are something that you're not, an awful lot of people are going to sniff that out, particularly if you have a long record, which is what Hillary Clinton has right now.
Yeah, that's true. And everything in that article was about electability. That's fine. That's what the terms of the article was. It was a political assessment. But, you know, absent, if she didn't know exactly where everyone stood and just had to make the most forceful argument, not just her, everyone in politics, maybe we'd get a better brand of politics.
Absolutely.
Like, if no one saw a poll, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I like progress. I like knowledge. Isn't polling just knowledge of what people think? I get that. But in general, if people said, hey, we're just going to make the arguments, and it turns out that our argument lost, maybe we'd get better policies resulting from that.
Okay, last jump of the tracks here. We're going to actually talk about sports for 2 seconds here with Mike Pesca. And that is now a two-week-old, at least, story, the story of Richie Incognito and Jonathan Martin of the Miami Dolphins, who I think won without either one of them on Sunday. I hope I don't have to reset this stage. We've been through it enough. But are there new developments? Is there a changing way of looking at this story?
Yes. Well, this is one of those things where I learned a lot late in the week and couldn't put in any of my reports, so I'd like to tell you.
Okay.
I talked to a guy named Ross Tucker, who's a former lineman, and he pointed out that Martin, I really got into the whole idea, you know, underpinning this whole bullying was they were trying to toughen Martin up. Is that possible? Tucker, Princeton graduate, said, I don't think it's possible, but at the time I probably did think it was possible. And he said to me, you know, there are a couple ways to play linemen, and we think of it mostly as brute strength. But there are really technically proficient linemen, guys who will never put their feet out of step, you know, guys who are just kind of really graceful. Sometimes those guys also have a mean streak. None of them are wimps, don't get me wrong. But sometimes those guys will, you know, finish their block and gleefully go and block three other players. Jonathan Martin was a guy who was a little bit technically proficient and definitely didn't have the mean streak. And what Tucker pointed it out, or actually I think I jumped on it and said, oh, okay, so what you're saying is, like, if you want a lineman to get better, there's no way that anyone outside or even inside the organization can do anything to make him work on his footwork. I mean, that's seen as more of like a natural, graceful skill, and unless the guy is simply, you know, brushing off his coaches when he says step this way, it's not something that we feel we can affect. But you feel you can affect toughness. So what Tucker was saying is, if this guy were a technically proficient lineman, which is kind of the lineman he wants to be, we wouldn't have even had to worry about his toughness, you know? It's sort of like saying, if a power hitter, if he was a great hitter for average or have a lot of speed, we wouldn't say, oh, this guy's a weakling. This guy isn't lifting a lot of weight in the weight room. So I thought that was a very interesting way to look at the whole Incognito Martin imbroglio.
And I thought, looking at Incognito's filing over the last couple of days, I think he asks a reasonable question, like, when did the Dolphins tell me I wasn't supposed to swear in the locker room and say horrible things to other people?
Yeah, I think everyone has a Richie Incognito in the locker room, maybe not with the voicemails or whatever. It's just that they have layers of people above Richie Incognito to say, hey, cool it now, and that's what the Dolphins missed. I also talked to a really smart psychologist at Colgate who did hazing experiments, and the two big things I took away from that were, one, hazing works. It doesn't really work well, but it definitely bonds you to the group. So, like, things like hazing and torture and all these things that have existed forever, it's not like they have no effect. I mean, we like to think, oh, torture never works. But, you know, they get you somewhere. They usually get the tortured person talking. Is he telling the truth? Probably not. But, you know, they get you talking. Hazing, does it bond you to the group? Yeah. Does it make you a confident person? Absolutely not. But she also said that people go into it feeling like geeks or weirdos, and Jonathan Martin's nickname by Richie Incognito was Jonathan Weirdo, don't see the hazing that they go through as as what most of us see, and most of us see it as, ooh, I must really think this group is important for me to put up with this or for me to go through this. If you already feel a little like an outsider, you just internalize it and blame yourself, and the hazing kind of doesn't take. And I think that perhaps is exactly what happened with Jonathan Martin.
All right. So who's the Richie Incognito of WNPR? I know, but I can't say because I'll get whacked in the head at the end of the show. But Mike Pesca, great to talk to you.
Okay. Good luck ducking Kyone's blows.
All right. No, it wasn't her. All right. I'm writing the name on a piece of paper right now, and I don't know what I'll do with it afterwards. We're going to take a little break. We'll come back with Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent.
You won't believe me. Are you a bully? Try and you will see that I am strong and I am brave, if only in my heart.
All right, we're back. It's our Monday show where we decide over the weekend what it is we want to talk about. And a lot of things happen over the weekend that get us excited. We're going to talk to Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent about some stories out of New Haven, especially one that got some big headlines over the weekend. In Hartford, we've solved the whole Election Day problem. We don't have big Election Day controversies because hardly anybody votes. But in New Haven, they haven't figured that out yet. People actually go out to vote, and sometimes there's some trouble about it. We're going to play a little clip for you called Let's Go. This is the sound of democracy in New Haven.
Let's go, 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 let's go. Down that way, go. Down that way. Down that way, come on. Marcus, show him where to go, Marcus, go. Tell him hurry up because you got to get him before 8 o'clock. Go, that's everybody, go. Go, 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 go. Go, 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 go. Before 8 o'clock, go, 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 go.
All right, that's democracy in action. That's Election Day in New Haven. What we're seeing in this video, which is up on the New Haven Independent website, is a lot of women getting out of a stretch limo. It's like one of those circus acts where too many clowns get out of one car. They're just like women pouring out of this car. But Paul Bass, what are we seeing? What's happening in that clip?
What's happening in that clip is it's about to strike 8 o'clock. The voting ball is about to end on Election Day. And at the last minute, someone who was working for the mayoral campaigns gets a stretch limo and goes to a drug treatment center on the other end of town and piles people into the limo to try to get them down to register to vote at the last minute and vote.
And so, and there's nothing basically wrong with that exactly. However, there have been some controversies about this, including the allegation, the kind of hard to pin down allegation that maybe when they returned, the women seemed to have consumed alcohol, or at least some of them had alcohol or beer or something like that in their breath, right? Which would be counterproductive for a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center.
And actually, they did fess up that there was drinking going on in the limo, which I know isn't the end of the world. I mean, there's an old tradition of back in New Haven elections when I started out reporting, there used to be a calculus of how many bottles of Boone's Farm and other liquors would have to be purchased at certain voting places in return for how many votes were supposed to be delivered. But, I mean, it's unclear what happened here except that they went to a drug treatment center. They brought a lot of people to vote who, by the way, did not end up getting to vote. Brought them back, smelled the liquor. They admitted there was liquor being consumed there. And the state got upset because they send $5 million a year to this agency. This isn't a voluntary place. This is, you got arrested, you either go to jail or you go to this place called Crossroads, which does a lot of important work. And they had arranged with the staff of Crossroads to bring people. This was not the first limo full going there. And the state for a while had suspended admissions into Crossroads while they made sure that there wasn't other funny business going on, and they are investigating why there were no staff people present in that limo.
Now, this is also a story to a certain degree, not to smear the entire concept with this story, but this is a story to a certain degree about Election Day registration, which was implemented for the first time this year. And I think when we were initially talking about Election Day registration, this might be the kind of scenario that we might have been worried about. Now, as you say, this particular group of women in that video didn't get to vote because whoever was driving the limo didn't understand that they had to go to City Hall first
right,
to do their Election Day registration and then to the polls, and it doesn't doesn't seem like they probably allowed enough time. Anyway, even if they'd known that, there probably wasn't enough time given the urgency of the let's go, let's go, let's go. But my understanding is there was a trip maybe from that facility earlier in the day which did do that two-step thing.
They did it sex segregated. They brought the males first. And there was someone there at the polls who happened to know they needed to go to a different location to vote. And, you know, you're right, Colin, this is a very tricky issue. So over 200 people in New Haven did vote that day because of Election Day vote registration. And it did allow more people to vote. And as a society, we definitely want the disenfranchised to be able to vote. That's always been a big challenge when we look at the pros and cons of bringing people to the polls. That's kind of it's a positive idea that you want to bring more people to vote. To what extent are they coming out of their own will? To what extent do different groups get advantages? For instance, the person who brought him in the limo knew somebody on the board, and they were both working for one of the mayoral candidates. Is that kosher? Well, it might be kosher because of the way group politics works and how you bring people to the polls, but it definitely makes some people uncomfortable. But Election Day registration itself seemed to be a success in New Haven, and people came for all sorts of reasons, and they did get to vote, and you want people to vote. You know, some of them were Yale students, some of them were people who just got, one woman just got here from Jamaica, but is a nursing assistant who can vote. So, I mean, I think it did increase democracy, but, you know, some of these incidents in New Haven, we've had a lot more problems with absentee ballot fraud, and that's changed my mind, Colin, about this cut-and-dry idea that supposedly it's always better to do everything to increase the number of people who vote. It seems like a good idea. Denise Merrill's for it. So is everyone who had the job before her. The Democratic Party's for it nationally. The Republican Party's against it because it tends to be people who vote against them. But, you know, when I see the amount of absentee ballot fraud that goes on every election in New Haven, and we had another story about it this time. We've had five instances of it that seem pretty clear in the last four elections. It makes me worried about having online voting. Because the people who are in there filling out people's absentee ballots for them illegally are going to be in there pushing the button for them. I do support the idea that we want more people to vote, more people from disenfranchised communities to vote, including Election Day registration. But some of this fraud that keeps going on in New Haven has given me pause about the way the debate is framed between Democrats who want the disenfranchised to vote, Republicans who obviously want to have bent the rules to intimidate people out of voting. But there's a legitimate issue of how do we balance the desire for greater numbers of voters against the desire not to have fraud and to have the vote mean something and be free.
We certainly want more people to vote. We don't want one person to vote more times by filling out somebody else's absentee ballots. That doesn't really accomplish the goal that we're looking for. You know, unspoken here so far is sort of back to the limo and the let's go, let's go, let's go. This seemed to be a get-out-the-vote operation for the ultimate winner of the election, Mayor-elect Tony Harp. And, you know, I mean, I'm also wondering, as she heads into office, there seem to be a couple of these little sort of stories kicking around. Not only about Election Day, but right before or right after Election Day. Maybe you were with me on Where We Live on the Wheelhouse talking about, I guess it was before, it was after that debate, about how there were some people coming forward who were associated with past instances of City Hall corruption, seemed to be kind of involving themselves with her. Does she need to send a different message now? Does she need to kind of send some kind of message to the people about sort of honest campaigning, honest government, open government, clean government?
I think the bigger message needs to be that she's going to include people who haven't been voting in elections 10 years ago or 20 years ago. What happened in the election, Colin, was the sort of, you might call them the new New Haven, people who moved here more recent years, more tend to be independent-minded, living in the downtown or East Rock, Yale areas, or the Westville neighborhoods, who are distrustful of old ways of doing business. You know, you and I were in those articles about people who were involved in corruption years ago, but it's also just about people who are skeptical of government organizations and party committees and labor unions, and they almost won that election. Mm-hmm. She didn't win by much. She went into it with a Bill de Blasio-type lead and ended up just barely winning. And I think there's a growing vote of people who've been involved in issues like from cycling to the environment to food to clean money and public financing, who have a set of issues and interests that weren't as prominent in New Haven 10 years ago, who were not part of her winning coalition. Whether they were concerned about the issues you and I just raised, or if it's just more policy-oriented, they're not showing up in her transition team. She is about to do a de Blasio move where she asks for people to send in ideas for this on the Internet. She's not constitutionally opposed to hearing hearing from lots of people. But that's going to be the big challenge, Colin, is to have 21st century New Haven participating in her administration along with the people who were in the first half of the John DeStefano administration.
Well, speaking of 21st century New Haven, if we can just switch gears here for a second here, many of us have very fond memories of things that happened at the old New Haven Coliseum, you know, going to see Jackson Browne with Orleans as the opener, having to navigate that corkscrew ramp in the garage. Going.
And weren't you at all those tractor pulls, too?
I think I went to a number of tractor pulls, but I was just so messed up, I don't remember them. And so that site has been sort of basically a parking lot. Now there's a proposal that seems to have everybody kind of excited here, a pretty massive proposal, although not scheduled for full completion until 2020, which seems like a long time to wait. New Haven Independent has been covering this. Paul Bass, give us a quick sketch of this.
Yeah, Colin, this is the biggest plan for downtown event we've ever had in our history. It's where the New Haven Coliseum was, right when you enter the city off the highway. $395 million plan, and it's basically a new urbanist dream. That's why a lot of people like it in theory. You're mixing a lot of stuff together in one place downtown. People live in there in apartments with a mix of incomes, stores, offices, recreational places, open green space within it. It's a several block area downtown, spilling over from the successful 9th Square development, which made a great downtown neighborhood. I'm a little skeptical, Colin, about the financing. I don't know if that, because what it's built, as you said, even though it doesn't end till 2020, there is a first phase that I think is very easy to build, which is housing. There's a real demand downtown. This plan partly hinges on the continuation of dismantling a mini highway through downtown that was built in the 60s and 70s that kind of destroyed the city, and they're trying to build back over. DeStefano, the mayor, has succeeded in building over part of it to reconnect downtown to the neighborhood. The developer of this plan is counting on the state coming through with some state and federal money through the Department of Transportation to even out that part of the highway again and have it be walkable and crossable again. So I think that it is an interesting idea. It's shown how the debate in New Haven has shifted since you and I started paying attention, that new urbanism is now what you're supposed to say if you want support. It can't be geared around the car. It can't be geared around suburban commuters. It can't be geared around single one big use projects with big buildings that look like they're going to fall on your head. It's got to be stuff that you feel is at a scale you can walk around with and see all different kinds of people doing all sorts of different stuff in the center of the city.
I think within new urbanism, too, one of the other really problematic terms is affordable housing. It can mean so many different things. I think at 360 State Street in New Haven, affordable housing is, you know, for people who make $58,000 a year or something like that.
Not if you have a family, actually, that they have the housing. The Public Housing Authority actually has 20% of the units. That's, for your listeners, 360 State is this big 32-story office tower that could build a couple blocks away from that in downtown New Haven. It's luxury housing beyond what anyone can believe. You pay an apartment $3,000-$4,000 for some apartment. But because in New Haven they're putting affordable housing downtown, I remember going to debates in Hartford where they're not doing this. Mm-hmm. 20% of those units are reserved for what you say, right? Affordable housing means a lot of different things. Sometimes it means not for the 1%, for the 2%. But some of those units are actually public housing units. Others, as you mentioned, are for people who are maybe making $50,000-$60,000 a year and don't have a family, so they're not poor or anything. Mm-hmm. But it actually, when you compare that to the kind of development that gets proposed in Stamford, Hartford, those cities, it is more of a mix than you usually see.
I guess the question really becomes, looking at this New Haven Coliseum, former New Haven Coliseum site, they're talking about, I think, 719 housing units. And you sort of wonder what affordable housing will mean as the thing gets built. Will it? Because there are homeless people in New Haven. There are people who are really low-income people who do need housing, and particularly housing in that area.
You know what's so interesting about that, Colin? Mm. That is two blocks from a big apartment complex built under the 9th Square, which was this version of the project in the early 90s, like a big downtown redevelopment. That is now a majority Section 8.
Hmm.
Now, there are people, they have kids that go to school and they go to jobs and they wait on the bus in the morning. Hmm. But there is affordable housing in there. I think you're totally right that those sensors have to be up, that affordable housing sometimes means very solidly middle-class housing. And, you know, cities, as you know, are now often becoming places for the very wealthy and the very poor. But the proof is going to be in the details of this, because it'll depend partly on how much subsidy the city gets. And often urban planners want to see a city developing one way, but then the reality of the incomes on the ground don't match that vision. So sometimes affordable housing, despite the best efforts of phonies who want to grab tax breaks, ends up being affordable housing.
All right, from your lips to the housing god's ears. Paul Bass, we're going to pause there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Colin.
And everybody should read the New Haven Independent. I've got a minute or so left. Let me just quickly mention just an interesting story since we're talking to one of the pioneers of journalism, Paul Bass, at the Hartford Current, the publisher, been the publisher for quite a few years now, Richard Graziano, is moving on within the Tribune Corporation. I'm sure there'll be more reporting about this today on WNPR. Moving on within the Tribune Corporation, Nancy Meyer, an official who's been, once again, on the business side of the paper, will be taking over as publisher. She, however, does have a pretty extensive background in the newspaper business. So those of us who worked for the Hartford Current in the past will be watching that with interest. She's worked, I think, for both the Hearst and Gannett newspaper chains in the past. So a strong newspaper background, new publisher at the Hartford Current. That might even be something we'll be talking about on the Wheelhouse on Wednesday. On where we live on Wednesday is at 9 a.m. is the Wheelhouse. I'm on it pretty much every week. And some of the stories that don't fit into the kind of thing that we wind up talking about here on Mondays do fit in on Wednesday. We may be talking about that as well as the Sudensky report about Sandy Hook, a bunch of other topics as well. So right now, we're going to get ready for a break. I do want to say, if you like what we're doing here on Mondays, if you like the fact that we're kind of being a little bit more immediate, not over planning the show, coming in on Monday, kind of sorting things out. If you like this format, or if you hate it, give me an email at wcolin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Also, don't forget, during the show, you can tweet us. Our tweet master, Greg Hill, is in the house right now. Tweet us at WNPR Colin, and we'll tweet back at you, too.
As a concerned parent, I don't want my kids voting if they're going to be drinking in limousines. They should have safe election day parties where there's no alcohol. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our interns, Jackie Lauper and Greg Dyson. Voiceover help in the intro by Tweetmaster Greg Hill. The part of Bill Curry was played by Taylor Swift. Go to WNPR.org for links, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff taking the Cheney sisters out to lunch. On tomorrow's show, our salute to the harmonica. And now, back to Colin.
Susan Bolgar is a chess grandmaster, winner of 5 Olympic gold medals in the Chess Olympiad, and she's the director of the Susan Bolgar Institute for Chess Excellence. She is covering the chess championship that is being talked about, I think, more than a chess championship has been discussed in many, many years. Susan Bolgar, welcome to our show, and tell us why that is, assuming you accept the premise that there seems to be a bit more media attention to this chess championship. Why would that be?
Well, thank you. First of all, it's a pleasure joining you on the air from Chennai. And indeed, it's, I think, perhaps the most followed match ever, in fact, even though in Fischer-Spassky match may have had kind of more interest in the U.S., obviously, because it had a U.S. participant. But because of the fact that it's being held in India, obviously the actual numbers are a lot bigger because of the population here. But I think also not just in the native countries of the two players, in Norway and India, that has a tremendous following. It's really on the first page on practically all the newspapers. It's on live television. It's really a chess craze going on in these two countries. But worldwide, it's also being followed all around the world. And I think the reason for that is because Magnus Carlsen brought something fresh and new to the game with his personality. He is very down to earth. He is very athletic. He's a model. And, of course, at the same time, a chess genius, while Vishy Anand, who is the reigning champion, has won 5 world championships, and he's a national hero here in India, and he's a true gentleman, and he's also very well-liked by his peers and his fans as well.
So you've got this Norwegian challenger, Magnus Carlsen, is in his early 20s. Anand is in his early 40s. And when you say Carlsen is athletic, I mean, he's a guy who, I mean, much has been made of his abdominal region, right?
Yeah, he has certainly also a lot of female fans. And, you know, I've seen him firsthand when he recently had his first competitive event in the U.S. He was in St. Louis. And, you know, not only that he competed in the tournament, but on the day offs, he used every opportunity to do sports. In fact, he came to visit to Webster University to do sports with our students there, and he played basketball, soccer, he played tennis, so he's very much into sports, not just chess.
And this is something that you, Susan Polgar, support, I think. One of the things I've seen you write about this, that just benefits from having superstars, having the kinds of players who get endorsement deals, who therefore kind of cross over into the mass media and make chess a little bit more front and center in the minds of the average non-chess-playing person.
Absolutely. I think chess is very fortunate that we got somebody so charismatic and well-rounded, the number one ranked player in the world as Magnus is. And I think if he wins this championship, of course, he has the lead right now, still five more games to go. But if he wins the championship, then I think chess will greatly benefit in that, you know, he, because of his personality, and he's a media magnet, and because of his diverse interest, you know, in sports and modeling, and he's a good, very good ambassador for the sport.
Here I'm about to venture into unsafe waters for me because I don't really know that much about chess. But reading the coverage and reading on your blog, I get the sense that in some ways the way that he's an unconventional sport, a chess star, and he doesn't necessarily resemble that much some of the chess champions of the past, kind of crosses over onto the board a little bit too. My sense is he's playing a little unconventionally, doing some things that his opponent Anand isn't expecting.
Yeah, definitely. He has a very unique style, and that's perhaps one of the reasons why all his opponents are having very much difficulty with, because traditionally the famous Russian or Soviet school of chess was a lot more straightforward, trying to get an initiative right from the beginning, right from the opening, and then try to follow up with that. On the other hand, Magnus has a very different, unique style in that he says, no, I don't want to start the game right out of the opening with the preparations. I don't want to get into that battle of who has a better preparation. I just want to get out alive from the opening, and then let's play chess. And obviously he has a tremendous self-confidence in his own skills in the middle game and the end game. And, you know, that's basically what he fully relies on, along with his amazing physical fitness, which helps him in the long games that he's looking for.
Yeah, and that's been suggested. And if you're not a chess aficionado, or I'll put it another way, if you want to get people excited about chess who don't know that much about chess, the last thing you want is for a high-profile match like this to have a lot of draws. Because although draws are very understandable and analyzable by chess experts, to the average person, a draw seems like a very boring outcome. And what I'm reading about Carlsen is that he doesn't like draws either. And in situations where many a chess master would accept the draw, he keeps on fighting and sometimes wins, maybe even partly because of that kind of stamina that you're talking about.
Absolutely, and that's what's so special about him, that, you know, some people joke about it, that maybe when, you know, he was taught the vocabularies of you know, the languages, they forgot to tell him about the word draw, and, you know, he basically plays on till the bitter end, And there was a specific moment, in fact, in this match, which I think was a psychological turning point, in Game 3, when Anand had actually a great game and everything looked good for him, and then he misplayed it. But then when finally the position got equal, and most grandmasters probably indeed would have agreed in a draw because it seemed like such an obvious outcome of the game, Anand offered a draw. And Magnus Carlsen said, I'd like to play on. And he did. And even though the game later on ended in a draw, when literally there were practically only the two kings and a couple other pieces left on the board, basically, you know, he went on and play on. And I think it was a clear message, you know, that, you know, I'm here to fight until the bitter end. And don't count on any early escape, you know, from the fight. And I think that's why one of the reasons why Magnus is so liked by all the chess fans and even the mainstream media and in general people, because he's not you know, trying anything different, but just let's play mano a mano at the board. You know, ignoring kind of the opening theories relatively to his level, and he's really only relying on his own stamina and skills.
We're talking to Susan Polgar. She's a chess superstar in her own right, a chess grandmaster often described as the person who broke the gender barrier in chess. She's the director of the Susan Polgar Institute for Chess Excellence at Webster University, and she's over in Chennai right now covering this. You know, as you look at Magnus Carlsen, obviously, in all the ways that we've been saying, he can be really, really great for chess, but probably it takes more than one person, and certainly what it has taken in other sports has been intense rivalries. So whether in chess there was Fischer-Spassky, in basketball there was Bird versus Johnson, in tennis there was McEnroe versus Borg. In some ways it seems as though one of the things that would really help chess is whether if Carlsen were to find somebody else to be that rival in match after match after match. Is that likely to be Mr. Anand, or is it likely to be someone else?
Well, I think Anand being almost twice his age, I don't think that's likely. But I think there are a few others who definitely will challenge him in the future. First of all, this match is not quite over yet either. But assuming that he'll win this match, I think there are some younger players like Aronian or Caruana or the American Hikaru Nakamura, or, of course, some of the Russian players like Vladimir Kramnik or some of the other younger Russian players that certainly, I think, will give him a run for his money. And I think those type of rivalries will develop.
Are any of those possible rivals women? Where's the next Susan Polgar coming from?
Well, I wish I don't see that in the very near future, but I hope that long term there will be a woman also who will challenge the world overall number one player as well.
Last question for you. What's it like in India right now? You sort of alluded to this at the beginning of our conversation, but how big an event is this chess championship in India right now? How much of the media does it dominate? How much do you sense it just being talked about around you?
Oh, it's just absolutely overtaking, I think, the Indian media. It is on live television here every day during the game, whether the game goes 2 hours or 4 or 5 or 6 hours. It's on live on national TV. I've been told that it's being watched by 80 million people, the live show, and then they have two highlight shows late in the evening and then the following morning. And those have been watched each show up to 120 million people just here in India. And then the same shows also are being aired in 48 other countries where they can catch these channels. And it's just absolutely tremendous here. Ever since we arrived, it has been in every single major newspaper cover stories and in the inside pages after pages reporting from different angles. And there has been a tremendous excitement like there would be for a major Super Bowl or World Series when it comes to football or baseball in the U.S.
Susan Pulgar, it's been exciting for us to get to talk to you. Susan Pulgar, a chess grandmaster, winner of 5 Olympic gold medals in the chess Olympiad, director of the Susan Pulgar Institute for Chess Excellence. Thank you for joining us today from Chennai, India.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Or take a rest. It's just a friendly game of chess.
I'm Kyon Wolf. All night in this hotel next to the place where they're playing this chess championship, there's all these fanatics in the lobby screaming about how good they are. And if there's one thing I can't stand, it's chess nuts boasting in an open foyer. Boom.